Coming to you live from the planet of Coruscant, it's the Hand Plus Podcast, where each week I, Joe Fricke, and my co-host Tristan Mayer break down this week in streaming. We talk about news, we talk about what we watched, what's coming up. We just kind of give everyone the layout of, hey, this is what you can expect to watch in streaming this week, next month. And you know, there's so many options out there, so many movies, so many shows, just so much dropping, especially right now, so much content coming at you, and it's kind of hard to figure out what can I watch, what can I skip, and that's what Tristan and I are here to do. Tristan, I'm gonna ask you the question I've never asked you before. How was your week in streaming?
Well, great question, Joe. We talked in a couple of previous episodes that like the beginning of the year was kind of slow. There was like drops here and there, but it wasn't like an overwhelming flow of stuff. And this week we definitely got an overwhelming flow of stuff. There was a lot that I watched, a lot that I wanted to watch, and I didn't have the time to get to. So yeah, it's gonna be a stacked episode. I know I watched some stuff you didn't watch, you watched some stuff I didn't watch, so it'll be good to come together and see on this big crowded week. You know, we have Last of Us finale. It's a big thing to talk about, a big debate going on about the morals of that finale and where people feel about the characters and things like that. So I'll talk about how I feel about the finale of Last of Us. And yeah, of course, a big episode of Mandalorian. We're actually going to have two episodes to cover for Mando this week. So yeah, stacked episode, Joe. I feel like I've talked enough already. Great week for me in streaming. I watched a lot of stuff. So how was yours?
Good. I actually watched some things this week. I know the last couple weeks I hadn't really gotten to what I wanted to get to, but I was able to watch a few things. So I'm excited to talk about what I watched. And yeah, normally we're trying to do these shows on Tuesdays now, but one of us had something come up, so we had to push this week to Wednesday. And just because of the release of Mandalorian coming out, Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning, depending on where you live, we were able to talk about the last two episodes this week. So yeah, it's going to be a Pedro Pascal heavy episode this week. And Tristan, you ready to start with some HBO Max news?
I'm definitely ready. A lot of news this week, too. We'll have to watch a lot of news.
All right, first bit of news for HBO Max. Drop the HBO, just Max. It's something I noticed a couple weeks ago. We talked a little bit about it, where I noticed a trailer for Elizabeth Olsen's new show didn't say, like, from HBO Max. It just said from Max. And now there's reports that the heads at HBO Max feel that the name HBO is scaring potential customers away, and there's a chance that maybe they do rebrand to just Max, which I personally feel is a dumb decision. But Tristan, kind of what are your quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, I understand their logic. You know, I wonder, is HBO kind of like this old school expensive thing? When people hear HBO, do they think expensive? You know, I wonder if that was more of their mindset. I think it makes sense to change the name around a little bit, maybe, but removing HBO feels like a stuffing with the gunshot. You know, like HBO is such a recognizable brand. Mm-hmm. One that comes with a sense of quality. You know, when you think of Last of Us, you think of Game of Thrones, like those are HBO shows. Even you go back to the classics like Sopranos and The Wire, like you think of HBO, you think of like the breaking of like the greatest dramas on TV. So it's a weird choice to want to remove HBO. I think they're going to come up with some kind of name. I would imagine they want to work in some kind of brand. Like Max, you look at Max and I don't know what that is. You know, you want to call it Warner Max, something like that at least. So you at least have the brand recognition of what studio you're signing up for, right? Because you want to know what you're getting out of it.
Yeah. Does Goofy Stun have a streaming service? Like, yeah, I think it's kind of not the best way to go about things.
I wonder what they'll do. Because you mentioned, I think, in a previous episode that some of the marketing for shows has said Max Original rather than HBO Max Original. So I'm wondering if that's a hint for where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, yeah, maybe they're going to lean into that. You know, the maximum streaming. Get your Max from everyone Max, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, HBO Max is in a weird place right now, so I'm not surprised that they're making up weird headlines like this. We'll see how it goes.
Yep. And then Hulu will replace it for the H in hand. If anyone wasn't aware of that, that's where we got the name for the hand plus. HBO Max.
We're going to have to call Prime. It the ham, you know? Got to add an M in there somewhere.
Yeah. HBO Max, Amazon Prime, Netflix, Disney Plus, all your other favorite streaming services was kind of our original name. And we also have Warrior Season 3 is premiering June 29th. I never got into Warrior, haven't watched it. I know you watched it, and I know you liked it. Are you excited June 29th? You got that date circled in your calendar?
I'm really excited. The first two seasons were awesome. It's like this great action-adventure show. It's like the action in this is incredible, you know? And like we've seen great action on TV, but this is honestly like some of the best action we've seen on TV. And shows like Last of Us, like there's good action scenes like once in a while, but this is an action show. You know, every episode you're getting crazy action and crazy fights, you know. So if you're into like the into the action, to the kung fu, that kind of stuff, you're going to get all of that in this. So I definitely recommend checking it out if you want to get your action fix, you know?
Yeah, I know. I'm pretty sure this show was somewhat based on, like, notes and script ideas and journal entries and stuff that Bruce Lee had, which he pitched as a show back in, like, the 70s and 80s, and I can't remember what studio it was, basically said, we'll pass on your show, and then took all of his notes and made the David Carradine-led show Kung Fu, so, which then got rebooted on the CW a couple years ago. So if you're a fan of that show back in the day, maybe check out Warrior on HBO Max. This is like
better than Kung Fu.
I was going to say, this is more like the modernized, updated, more production value, higher quality version of that. And also, obviously, show we've talked about a bit, Last of Us season finale scores 8.2 million viewers, its final episode. For a television show, these are pretty insane ratings.
Yeah, and for a platform that seems to be like struggling a little bit to gain like social traction, to have something this huge and this talked about is great. You know, I'm going to bridge this a bit into my review of the finale, I guess. It makes a good point to bring it up. And I mentioned before that the ending of The Last of Us is one of the more divisive moments, I think, in pop culture media. I remember when the game came out and seeing people arguing in the reviews and talk online about, not even argue, but just like debate the moral quandary that Joel finds himself in the finale here, and the choice that he makes at the end to save who he saves, and for the reason he does it and the way he does it. You know, he really falls back into his violence, and he falls back into like all of that trauma that he was spending the whole entire show to escape. You know, I think it's a great finale, a great ending, and the show has been up and down at points, but I think it wrapped up just incredibly. This finale captured all of that gut punch, all of that kind of like quiet distaste in your mouth from finishing the game, and you're like, okay, I got what I wanted, but is it even what I really wanted? You know, you spend the whole series thinking you want to see this, and then once they give it to you, you're like, man, that's just depressing and hard to watch and kind of leaves you feeling empty, you know? And I think that's a great way to end with this kind of a show. You never get any easy answers. I think people are online trying to make like these big moral grandstands about, you know, if you felt this way about Joel's actions, you're evil. If you felt this way about Joel's actions, you're heartless. And I think the reality is that Joel made a personal and very emotional and individual choice. And how you feel about that reflects a lot about who you are and how you view other people and how you view yourself and your role in society. And there's no easy answers to that question. I don't want to spoil it for you, Joe, because I know you do end up at some point want to watch this first season. But I'd love to get your thoughts on the choice Joel makes here at the end. And I think I mentioned that some of the action scenes leading into this finale were kind of a letdown, that I didn't necessarily feel like they were going far enough, especially with the infected and with kind of the action side of this series. It felt like much more of a drama and much less of an action show. And they gave me a lot of action in the finale, and it was to the point where I thought, you know what? I said I wanted this, but it's so brutal and it's so kind of just hard to look at that you're like, did I want this? You know, and I think that's what The Last of Us is really about. It's about these vengeance quests, these people who are going on these traditional narratives that in one world would have felt very satisfying. You know, when you see Joel kind of do what he does and save Ellie and make that choice in a different narrative, that would have been a great ending. You know, you're going to be cheering, saying, oh, I'm glad to see Joel doing this and killing all these bad guys. But in the context of The Last of Us, it just kind of hurts. And you're seeing this character who's made a lot of growth and a lot of progress just kind of fall back into his old violent ways. And it's hard to watch. It's very moving. It's kind of heart-wrenching. And it sets you up for an incredible second season of The Last of Us, where the consequences kind of come after these people. And now you kind of twist the narrative around and you get a different perspective on events. So, yeah, it really, really brought the season home for me. I talked about how I was kind of up and down on it. But once I got to the finale, I think it wrapped it all up so well. And it kind of made the lack of action throughout the series feel like it was almost intentional. You know, so you get to this point and you're finally given all that action, but you're like, man, it's not really what I was wanting, you know? So I love the ending here. I can't wait to see where they go for the second season. I know they're going to be starting filming, like, if not this year, next year. So pretty soon. It's going to probably be a year or two until we get season two of The Last of Us. But I can't wait to see how they build on that story, where they go from here. Are they going to just do a direct season-to-season adaptation like they did last time? Or are they going to see these numbers and be like, oh, let's drag it out a little bit. You know, let's turn one game into three seasons or something like that. Or let's add in some extra story here and there. And I can't wait to see how adding things and changing things around shapes the second game. Because if you thought the ending of this was divided, just wait till you get to the first 20-30 minutes of The Last of Us Part 2. You know, I can't wait to see how that finale, how that premiere goes for people watching at home. I can't wait, and it's going to be a long, long wait for season 2.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited to watch it. I vow I'm going to finish season 1 before season 2 premieres. Without a doubt, I'm going to watch it. Everything I've heard about it makes me excited to watch it, so I'm definitely going to watch it. And when I do, I'll let you know my thoughts on the finale of season 1.
I can't wait to hear it, Joe, because I'm sure you'll have passionate feelings one way or another.
All right. I'm excited to talk about it. You ready to move over to Amazon?
I'm ready. Sad to say goodbye to Last of Us, but we'll be back in a handful of years talking about it some more.
All right. So, first bit of news from Amazon Prime. Batman the Caped Crusader is moving from HBO Max to Amazon Prime with a 2-season order. So anyone who doesn't know, this is an animated series that was co-produced, kind of curated, between the two guys that were actually co-created the Kerry Russell starring show Felicity back in the day, Matt Reeves, who's currently directing the active Batman franchise, and J.J. Abrams, who people know from Mission Impossible 3, Star Wars Episode 7 and 9. He also did Star Trek 2009. So I didn't even know this was possible. Like, honestly, I figured with a Batman show, Warner Brothers, everything, I figure if HBO Max says we don't want it, it was kind of dead. So the fact that it's going to Amazon Prime is kind of interesting. Amazon Prime has done very well with their superhero-related content from The Boys and The Boys and Invincible. And this kind of leads me to believe, especially if it's Amazon Prime, it can be a lot darker and more violent, and potentially HBO, if it was something on HBO Max that, obviously, they have The Last of Us, they have Game of Thrones. They're not exactly kid-friendly, but with a property like Batman, they may, especially being animated, they may be, have tried to steer it more towards kids. But I'm very curious to see how the show ends up. What are your thoughts on the show and it moving to Amazon Prime?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I was already looking forward to it when it first got announced. I don't want to only say that it was Matt Reeves and J.J. Abrams, because Bruce Timm is also involved in the show, who was a creator of the Batman animated series and shepherded that whole animated universe, you know, Superman, the animated series, Justice League, Batman Beyond. So he's definitely having a big touch in here. So I'm curious to see if it feels like, you know, the Batman animated series picked up again. You know, is it going to have that similar style, that similar tone? Of course, Kevin Conroy is no longer with us here on this earth, so he won't be voicing Batman in this show, which is unfortunate. But I'm looking forward to it, and it's just interesting. As much as I'm looking forward to the show, I feel like it's more interesting, like, how it ended up on Amazon, you know? And I wonder if that's going to be the first of a couple of things that Warner Brothers Discovery ends up shoehorning off to some other platforms, because we know that they're kind of hemorrhaging cash right now, and the couple of movies coming out this year don't necessarily seem to be, like, promising box office releases, necessarily all of them. You know, they have some that are coming out that are going to be huge, like Dune 2 and Barbie, I think they're going to make a lot of money, but Shazam 2, Blue Beetle, I don't necessarily see them breaking the bank, you know? So I wonder if this is the first. The Flash, I'm sure The Flash will make some money. You know, they're very confident in The Flash. But I'm curious if the fact that HBO passed on this, does it mean that it's not good? You know, that's also where I think, like, if they had a great animated series with the current head of the Batman movies and then the classic head of the Batman animated show, like, that feels like free money. And the fact that they passed on it makes me also wonder if maybe the show just wasn't looking that good, you know, and they'd rather cash in and make the money now. It's not the first time they sold off another DC show to Netflix, another DC animated show, not based off of Batman, based off of a different DC character. So I'm wondering, you know, maybe there is some truth in all those weirdo Snyder people out there saying that Netflix is going to buy the Snyderverse, you know, and bring it back to life. I thought there was a 0% chance, but now maybe there's like a 0.1% chance.
I mean, that is possible. I didn't think about that aspect of, I mean, if HBO is willing to sell off parts of things and obviously roles are getting recast, imagine they do. Netflix goes to HBO and says, for X amount of money, we want to be able to continue Zack Snyder's DC Universe. Could be rather interesting. And honestly, it's not crazy to say it's going to happen anymore.
Yeah, I would have said it was crazy about a week ago until this headline came out, and now maybe it's not all that crazy. And I think it's notable that both of these shows are animated, so I'm thinking if Zack Snyder's Justice League does get restored and his Snyderverse has come back to life, it will not be in the way that he would have originally done it. You know, I'm imagining it'd be like an animated show, an animated movie, something like that to wrap up the story, not necessarily, you know, like 20 different movies for all the different characters type of thing, you know? And I'd be happy about that.
What's the DC show on Netflix?
I cannot remember the name of it at this point now.
All right, you talk
I can find it while you're talking. You know?
Talk about that, and I will bring up the next story, and then you can answer that question. So we have Michael B. Jordan, who just directed Creed 3, a movie I've not yet seen. I'm definitely 100% going to see it this weekend. But he wants to do a Creed universe on Amazon Prime. Amazon Prime owns MGM Studios, and they're the ones who own the rights to Rocky and Creed. And I know Stallone has come out and said he wants his rights back. He feels like he was taken advantage of. But I also feel like back in the day, like I've heard that story of he essentially sold the rights so he could play Rocky. He sold the rights for cheap because he wanted to play Rocky. He wrote the movie for him to play it, and I think that's just the deal he made. It sucks now, but I think if he didn't make that deal back in 1975, he wouldn't be a household name. He would just be a random nobody that people remember as the guy who wrote Rocky. But I'm very curious to see what more can be done. Like, are we going to get an Apollo Creed series of a guy rising up as a boxer in the 70s? Are we going to get, like, a Clubber Lang series? Are we going to get a continuation of maybe Ivan Drago's story? I'm curious how much there really is to tell. I know Michael B. Jordan said something about like a Rocky-inspired anime, which I'm not a big anime person, but I feel like if they're not going the Star Wars route of like, oh, all of these things are interconnected in canon, it's just different projects inspired by Rocky, I feel like that'd probably be the way to go, because I feel like there's not really a ton of different directions you can go with this. But do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, follow up for a second and mention that the show that moved from HBO Max to Netflix is called Dead Boy Detective. It's Neil Gaiman, DC Vertigo creation about two people who die as young children, but instead of going to the afterlife, they decide to stay on Earth and become detectives who hunt down supernatural-related cases. So if you like that kind of week-by-week, case-by-case kind of structure, I'm imagining that that will kind of follow that structure. Neil Gaiman has a unique touch to that supernatural kind of stuff, so I'm looking forward to that. And they are also Netflix producing Sweet Tooth, which is also a DC Vertigo property. They're coming back for a second season this year, with Jason Momoa, I believe, is in the show. So they have two DC properties. And if you're counting Sandman, I guess they've got three, you know?
Yeah, I guess they're doing a lot of DC Vertigo stuff, so yeah.
And I'll say on Creed, the third Creed was very anime-inspired. Like, the action sequences, especially that final fight, felt like you were watching, like, Dragon Ball Z or something, you know? And I feel it was very creative. It was like nothing I'd ever seen in a Rocky movie before. So I'm really excited to see what Michael B. Jordan brings to this. And I feel like if he wasn't involved and I hadn't seen Creed 3, I'd be like, oh, Rocky anime, that sounds terrible. Or at least, like, some filler content I wouldn't necessarily want to watch, you know? But that I love what he did with Rocky or with Creed 3. I love the unique take on the fights. And if he's involved in the anime and he's kind of like overseeing some of the visual style of it, I think that's going to be like Michael B. Jordan's dream come true. You know, he's a big anime fanboy. He's worked anime and influenced into all of his performances and all of his costumes and things like that. So I'm really hoping that he's going to be able to be involved in this, because that's going to be a lot of fun to see someone with that level of a creative mind kind of be able to let loose in this franchise. Sure, he didn't create Rocky, but I feel like he's very much a shepherd of the Creed franchise. You know, he's brought it into what it is today, and it wouldn't really be any level of popular today if it wasn't for him in that lead, I think. I think he really carried that franchise, and especially creatively in the last one. So I can't wait to see what he does with this. And I don't necessarily know if the Rocky franchise is one that needs to be built out and expanded upon like all of this, but if it's going to be good, it's going to be good, you know? And Creed 3 made me feel like a Rocky anime could be awesome, especially if Michael B. Jordan is involved. So I'm looking forward to that for sure.
Yeah, I feel like I already kind of mentioned the three stories that I think you could do, and anything beyond that, I feel like it would be redundant.
Yeah, that's my biggest thing, is how do you not make this redundant? And Creed 3 almost was on the edge of being redundant until it was because of that unique style, because of that unique take on the fight sequences that kind of saved it from just being very, very repetitive. Yeah. And I don't know how a week-to-week Rocky show doesn't become very, very repetitive.
Yeah. All right. And moving on, we also have Above the Line is reporting that Oscar Isaac is set to play Kurt Vonnegut in the Amazon series Helltown, from Robert Downey Jr. and All Quiet on the Western Front director Edward Berger. I'm going to be honest, I don't know much. I know Kurt Vonnegut was a writer, but I don't know much about him other than his appearance as a cameo in the Rodney Dangerfield movie Back to School, where Rodney Dangerfield basically played the CEO of a big and tall clothing store, like a big franchise clothing store. He never went to college. He just kind of rose up. And when his son goes to college, he's like, I never spent enough time with my son. I'm going to go to college too. and he's kind of cheating in his classes, doing this all to get by. And he has to write a report on Kurt Vonnegut, and he hires Kurt Vonnegut to write a report on Kurt Vonnegut, and he gets the report back from his professor saying whoever wrote this paper doesn't know the first thing about Kurt Vonnegut. And that's all I know about him. That's where my knowledge begins and ends. I didn't see All Quiet on the Western Front, but obviously, we'll talk about it a bit later. It was very critically successful. Robert Downey Jr. as a producer is kind of hit or miss to me, but I love Oscar Isaac as an actor, so overall, net positive, but if it's one of those things where the, you know, reviews come out and the show sucks, I'm probably not going to watch it. But if the reviews are, hey, this show's like really good or it's amazing, I'll definitely check it out. But Tristan, where are you standing on this Kurt Vonnegut series for Amazon Prime?
Yeah, I have a couple of feelings. I think the attachment of Ed Berger is a really good timing. You know, he'd come right off of winning a bunch of Oscars, and like the next day he's got this headline. You know, as fun as it is to watch the Oscars and celebrate the movies of the past, it's also a night where you're looking for like the movies of the future, you know, and you see people win a bunch of awards, you start to wonder like what's their career gonna look like after this, you know. And I think that's a great headline, a great addition to this show. And I am also a big Kurt Vonnegut fan. I read a lot of his novels. I was a huge fan of him in like high school and college. He was really influential on me and my taste and the way that I look at the world and things like that. I think if you know me and you know Kurt Vonnegut, that might not be a huge surprise, but he's also kind of an odd guy. He has an odd history, kind of a weird personality. So I'm curious to see how Oscar Isaac captures the oddities of Kurt Vonnegut. And I also am really looking forward to the premise of this, because it follows Kurt Vonnegut before he's famous. At this point, he's like a struggling author, just trying to break it out. He's working a day job, not quite sure if he's going to make it as an author. And in that process, he ends up getting entangled in a murder mystery in his local town, where there's a man and woman are murdered and their bodies are found nearby. And the real life Kurt Vonnegut ends up getting himself entangled into this murder mystery and becoming kind of attached to the prime suspect and falling himself into the spiral of this whole murder cycle. I don't know how much of this is a true story, how much of it's just like a fictionalized take on Kurt Vonnegut, but either way, that sounds awesome. And I'm curious how much they're going to bring in like the Kurt Vonnegut strangeness through this show. Is it going to feel like a Kurt Vonnegut novel come to life in its own way? I'm looking forward to that. And Oscar Isaac is one of, if not the greatest actors working right now, so I can't wait to see what he does on the show. I'm looking forward to this a lot. And yeah, as a big Kurt Vonnegut fan, I'm probably going to be rereading some of my favorite books from him leading up to this. And yeah, I'll be watching this definitely. So if Joe's not covering it, I'll be covering it.
All right, great. And speaking of things you're covering, you also watched the final half of Daisy Jones and the Six. I know you enjoyed the first half. How was the second half?
It's pretty solid. You know, I'm not blown away by this, and I think the fact that it's not super engaged with is showing that it's not extra great. I don't know how to review something where my basic review is that it's fine. You know, if you like the premise, you like the setting, you're going to like the show. You know, it plays into the 70s band stuff. You have the Elvis legacy of the lead, and you get to hear her sing, and you have like these little wisps of Elvis in her singing voice too, and it's kind of cool to see that come to life. And I think what really holds the show back is that the setting is cool, the premise is cool, but they don't necessarily do much interesting in the actual like plot of the show. You know, it just ends up being kind of a relationship drama about Daisy Jones and the people she's with. And I didn't find it all that compelling by the end. I like that I watched it. I'm happy that I watched it. It was worthwhile of a watch. But if the premise doesn't grab you, it's not going to win you over, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you are attached to that setting and that tone and the music world of the 70s, you're going to have a good time with this, but you're not going to, I don't think you're going to be blown away with this. You know, I don't think it's going to be on anybody's like list of the best shows of the year, but it could end up on somebody's list of like the shows you should have watched that you didn't watch last year type of list, you know?
Yeah, I get that. It's kind of more like if you watch this trailer and it seems like your thing, you'll enjoy it. But if you watch the trailer and it doesn't seem like your thing, the show itself is probably not going to win you over.
Yeah, it's not going to blow the genre, like blow the walls off the genre, you know? So you know where you're getting from it, and you're going to get what you want, and that's basically it.
All right. Ready to move over to Netflix?
I'm ready. What do we got from Netflix, Joe?
All right. First bit of news from Netflix. I Think You Should Leave Season 3 is premiering May 30th. I've never watched a single episode of this show. I know it's just like a comedy sketch show. You and a friend of the show, Johnny, are both fans. Why should someone watch this show?
It's just great. It's hilarious. I love that this show captured so much of like the weirdness of people. You know, I think what makes this show so interesting is you're following this guy. It's a sketch show, so there's no plot. It's just kind of like various little situations that he puts himself in, and that, now I can't remember the guy's name. That's the main host, Tim Robinson. He's an odd performer, and he puts himself in these situations where he's like a double, tripling, quadrupling down on like the wrong thing. You know, there's a really famous sketch in the season where they're at this really fancy clothing store, and like the Oscar Mayer hot dog car drives right through the front door and smashes all this stuff, and the customers are standing around trying to figure out who did this, and then in comes the main character in a full Oscar Mayer wiener costume saying, look, we're trying to find out who did this. We're all trying to figure out who did this crash, and they're all telling him, dude, it's you. We know it's you. You're literally wearing an Oscar Mayer hot dog costume. Mm-hmm. And he's like, it could have been anybody. You know, it could have been any of us. And you're just following this guy, like, quadrupling down on insane takes, you know, and you have actual great guest stars too. Steven Yeun popped up for an episode. So I have a great time watching this. It's hilarious. I'm like crying laughing at some of these shorts, and it's just very funny. It feels after our time too, where people are willing to like triple down on like the worst takes you've ever heard in your life, and they'll come and start fighting about it and saying that they're right and pulling out all this evidence they're making up and spreading misinformation just to be right, you know. And it honestly feels like it captures the weirdness of social media, and it's not about social media at all, but it feels like it captures being on social media, and you're seeing somebody double down on some really, really bad wrong take, and this becomes hilarious. And yeah, I can't wait to watch season 3. I'll be talking about it on here, but I highly, highly recommend it. It's so bingeable too, because it's like they're all so short format that you can just throw on an episode, and next thing you know, it's over. Next thing you know, you're watching the next one, and it's over. And yeah, I think you'll love it, Joe. So anyone who's out there and just wants to laugh at just increasingly bizarre situations and how this guy gets into, you know, just unhinged situations. There's a moment where he's on a date and he's trying to like eat the other person's food and trying not to ask for it. He's trying to like get the other person to offer him the food so he doesn't have to ask for the food. And the other person's like, are you trying to eat my food? And he's like, what? No, I'm not trying to eat your food. And then it just becomes like this whole doubling down on that. And I love this show. I can't wait to watch more of it. So yeah, I can't wait for this season. And I'm hoping that it lives up to the first two, because the first two seasons are both just great.
All right. And that show is called I Think You Should Leave. And you ready to move over to some Oscar news?
I'm ready. Let's give us some Oscar news.
All right. We have Guillermo del Toro won Best Animated Feature for Pinocchio. We also have Elephant Whispers winning for Best Documentary. And then All Quiet on the Western Front won Best International Feature, Best Original Score, Best Cinematography, and Best Production Design. So Netflix, obviously, I believe, well, they did Roma, right? So they've won Best Picture before, but now they didn't win Best Picture, but they won 6 out of the 24 categories. So a big night for Netflix. I know a lot of people left the Oscars talking about A24 and that production studio and how many they won. But Netflix had a pretty good night as well. So what are your thoughts on Netflix coming away with a quarter of the Oscars?
Yeah, everyone's talking about A24, and it was honestly very funny that Jimmy Kimmel and a lot of people in the show are mentioning like, oh, it's good to be back in the theater, watch movies that are supposed to be watched, you know, in the theater. And then meanwhile, like, half the awards are given out to a Netflix movie, which was not, well, I guess it was released in theaters technically, but yeah. You know, not a wide release. So I mean, I liked All Quiet. I'm glad that they won some stuff, technical awards, and I love Del Toro, so happy to see him. I think what's most interesting about this, and also about the Oscars in terms of our show, is when you go through the list here, nearly every single movie that won an award outside of one or two was streaming by the time awards voting closed. Yeah. So I think that definitely helped a lot of these awards. And I think going forward, I would be surprised if studios don't want to get their movies streaming by the time the Oscar voting closes. You know, and I understand Avatar wanted to like make more money, right, in theater, but I also think they would have had a better shot at winning some more awards if it was streaming on Disney Plus by the time the awards came around, you know, and stuff like Everything Everywhere that had this whole entire year of buildup, you know, someone who might have watched that in February or March might have been not been into it. And then, you know, come award season, they're like, you know what, it's on Showtime, I'll give it a watch and see. And then all of a sudden they like it more, you know. Yeah. And I'm curious how they're going to adapt into the future, because I think it's very, very notable that even on the short film categories, like, those are streaming too. And I think that really, really helps to have these be in the consciousness, to be talked about all the time, you know. And I think that's really going to be something that I think studios are going to look at going forward, is if you want to win, we got to have our movies out and available. Even Women Talking, which won for adapted screenplay, and kind of an upset, not necessarily a huge upset, but it was not projected to win necessarily. It was on the second or third of the ranking, but the fact that it was free on Amazon Prime right when Oscar voting was happening, I think that might have helped it a little bit to get that edge. People who were like, I haven't watched it, I'm going to check it out I'm prime before I cast my vote. I think that might have been a good move for them.
Yeah, and I think also not only does it help movies win, I think it helps the Oscars themselves in viewership. There was an uptick in Oscar viewership this year compared to previous years. Obviously, it's still down massively from like 4 or 5 years ago, but the last couple of years it's been steadily dropping, and this is the first year it rose, and I think this is part of that because, you know, a lot of these movies, especially as it's these smaller, more independent movies that win and people are really only going to go to the theater for the bigger spectacle movies. People look at the Oscar nominees and they're like, oh, I haven't seen any of these. And so they have no reason to watch the Oscars. But now with so many of these movies available to watch on Netflix, HBO Max, Amazon Prime, they see the Oscar nominees and they're like, okay, I've seen these four, and then I can go watch these like two or three interest me, and I can go watch them right now for free with the subscriptions I already have. So I think not only does it help the movies, but it helps the Oscars, because if you haven't seen the movies, you don't care, and if you've seen the movies, it allows you to care and have a reason to root for one or two of them.
Yeah, I think it's a great move for both. And yeah, we mentioned that the Oscars, we slightly thought might end up streaming on a platform this year, but it did not. So I'm curious if next year... Mm-hmm. Did they move off of ABC, or is this uptick in viewership enough to convince them to stick around on ABC? You know, because yeah. I was wondering if they go to Disney Plus next year or Hulu or something like that, does their viewership skyrocket? The fact that it's not on basic cable anymore, it's on something more a lot of people already have, Disney Plus. I'm wondering if that helps or hurts, and I'm curious if they stick it out on ABC for another couple of years, at least, you know, through the 100th or something like that, and see how it goes.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes as more movies are on streaming, especially. And maybe the Oscar viewership can get... It won't ever get where it was before with the 40 million, but see if we can get up above 25.
Yeah, because I think that is less about the Oscars. I mean, it's partially about the Oscars, right? But it's also about the fact that linear TV in general has decreased in viewership, you know? People aren't watching it like they used to be watching it. You know, there's so much of... For one, there's streaming, right? If you're not, might not even be on your TV, but there's also just so many other channels. You know, if you have cable, you have like hundreds of channels to be watching, so you might not be watching 3, 5, 7, and 9 every night, you know?
Yeah. All right. Let's stick with Guillermo del Toro. And Variety is reporting that Guillermo del Toro is eyeing Mia Goth, Andrew Garfield, and Oscar Isaac to star in his next film, which will be debuting on Netflix. And that is a remake of Frankenstein. I know this is a movie he's wanted to make for probably as long as he's been making movies. So I feel like there's going to be a lot of passion behind this. And, just a lot of thought put into this movie, a lot of detail put into this movie. And Tristan, what are your thoughts on Guillermo del Toro finally getting to make his Frankenstein movie?
I think this sounds awesome. The cast is just stacked. You know, Mia Goth, Andrew Garfield, those are like buzzing names among especially young people. Like, this is really going to get a lot of young audiences to be watching this. And Guillermo del Toro, you know, he's an old soul. He's been in Hollywood for a long time. He's made some great classics years and years and years ago. So I think merging him with people who really appeal to the young audience is going to be a great, great hit for Netflix. And yeah, Frankenstein plus Guillermo del Toro, that's a great combination. So yeah, I'm over the moon happy for this. This sounds awesome. I cannot wait to watch it.
All right, me too. I'm excited for it. We also have an untitled show from Michael Schur, who people may know. He worked on The Office, co-creator of Parks and Rec, co-creator of Brooklyn Nine-Nine and The Good Place. Has a show starring Ted Danson, with a log line of a retired man who gets a new lease on life when he answers an ad from a PI and becomes a mole in a secret investigation. And that has gotten an 8-episode order, and it's based on the Oscar-nominated documentary The Mole Agent. So Michael Schur and Ted Danson re-teaming up. The show sounds like, I'm sure, I haven't watched the documentary. I can't imagine there was much comedy in the real documentary, but I imagine this will be a much more comedic take on this story. I don't really know if Ted Danson's going to be the PI or the guy who calls the PI, but I think either way it'll work. Tristan, what's your thoughts on this story?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. That his track record for shows is, you know, 10 out of 10, essentially. Everything he's made has been good, at least good. And Ted Danson in The Good Place is great. You know, that was a great combination. I think he's one of the better performers on that show. And I'm looking forward to this. And yeah, the tone's going to be interesting. I want to watch that documentary because obviously I haven't seen it. I don't think I even heard of it until this headline, but I'll watch it before the show comes out. And yeah, I can't wait to see how he balances that tone. And especially The Good Place, I thought was like a really unique sitcom. It really broke kind of like the tropes of what you think of the sitcom. It really changed the way you tell stories in a sitcom and moved into kind of like existential questions and like mature questions and themes that I really appreciated. So, yeah, I'm curious how he's going to merge the tones of this and if he's going to kind of break norms again. Because you talk about The Office, that was really a norm-breaking TV show that people still talk about today and still are invested in today. So, yeah, I cannot wait to see this. And it could be one of those shows that comes and goes and ends up being one of his misses or something like that. But with that track record, it's hard to believe that it would just come and go.
Yeah, I agree. We also have Nancy Myers had a rom-com ordered by Netflix, and it got dropped and canceled because the reported cost on it was $130 to $150 million, which is insane for a rom-com to cost that much. But, you know, I've done research and looked it up, and a lot of the reasons the rom-coms of the past succeeded is because you'd have, like, these two big-name stars as your leads, and they wouldn't take much up front, but they take a lot of the back-end points and make money off the box office. But now with all of these rom-coms being on streaming, there is no back-end points, and, you know, they're still trying to get paid their money because they are big stars who, you know, have a lot of draw and a lot of people wanting them in their movies, and they're like, I want to make $40 million or $50 million from this movie, and Netflix just can't afford to blow $100 million just on paying actors. And Tristan, so my question for you is the rom-com dead until they figure out a new way to make them or a new formula for a rom-com?
I don't know if it's only rom-coms. I feel like movies in general that are made originally for streaming are going to hit this wall. You know, The Gray Man cost like $200 million. You know, Netflix could not have made that money back, you know? And a lot of that does go to the stars. I feel like Netflix and streamers in general are going to have to figure out how do we pay stars without ballooning our budgets to irrationally high fees. You know, do we figure out a way to do a back end, you know, to pay them based off of the viewership numbers their show gets? Of course, that would mean we'd have to release the viewership numbers probably to fairly equate the pay in the after. But I'm curious how that goes, because yeah, it's not sustainable. I would have loved to see this. Nancy Myers has an incredible track record. If you don't know, she made The Parent Trap, Lindsay Lohan, What Women Want with Mel Gibson. You know, The Intern was actually really, really good, and that had Robert De Niro and Anne Hathaway, pretty big name stars in that. And that was almost 10 years ago at this point. So this would have been her return after like 10 years nearly of not directing anything. And yeah, I feel like it's a sad state where the rom-com doesn't... What was the last big rom-com we had? You know, you have Ticket to Paradise with George Clooney. Deadpool, I guess you could count as a rom-com. But this one, the cast list was so stacked too. I really would love to see a big stacked ensemble cast like that again. But it does feel like in the streaming era, we're not really getting huge ensemble cast anymore. You know, you're going to have your one or two big name leads, and then it's going to fill the rest of the cast with like C tier TV actors you don't know, you know? And I feel like this was exciting because it was all these big names swinging around for the last couple of months. Who are they going to cast? Ooh, Scarlett Johansson's attached to this. Who's attached to this now? And now it's just not going to happen. And that kind of sucks. I wish they would have been able to find a middle ground of, okay, maybe you don't, you know, have $150 million. Maybe you get like 100, you know? But it is sad that the Russo brothers can get like a blank paycheck to make the most generic action movie you've ever seen in your life, and you can't do the same thing for Nancy Myers. It feels like there's a double standard there, you know, because they're not going to be canceling Extraction 2 or Gray Man 2. They're still going to be coming out, you know. So I wonder why the double standard when all of a sudden it's a rom-com, it's a female director, and all of a sudden Netflix is crunching their numbers and saying, oh, look, we got to rub our pennies together. We can't be doing this. But next year they're going to release a $300 million action flop that no one watches, you know. Yeah.
So my question for you is, do you think there's a chance that we go back to the old school studio system style where they try to find up-and-coming talent who, you know, it's kids just trying to make it into the industry, and they're like, hey, we'll give you $150 million, but you have to do three movies, you have to do two shows, this, that, and the third, and they can hopefully slowly build a star until the time that they're in one of these rom-coms that they are a big name because they've been in a bunch of Netflix stuff that people have watched?
Yeah, I think that the contract is going to be what they have to go back to. And I know talent doesn't really want to sign on for big, huge multi-film contracts. You know, they look at the Marvel pipeline and they say, oh, someone was signed for 9 films and they had to give up 20 years of their life to the Marvel studios. I don't want to do that, you know. Yeah. But it's going to come down to you either sign on to the Netflix contract, you give them a first look deal or something like that, and or you just don't work on streaming, you know. And we have a whole, you might end up with like a little niche of people who work on streaming all the time and then don't go into the rest of the industry, and then we're going to have our movie stars who make the big stuff. But yeah, I can't wait to see it, especially as you can deny it all you want, but the industry is changing towards streaming. You know, the theaters are not making necessarily what they were making before. They're making good money, but 10 years from now, are we going to be watching stuff in the theater every week, or are we going to be watching some stuff in the theater once in a while, but mostly on streaming? And I feel like it's just a problem they got to solve, because I like movie stars. I like great actors who have really huge running careers, and I don't want to see a future where Netflix is only hiring on like the C-tier people who will say yes to them, you know? Mm-hmm. And I want to see actual good celebrities, good acting. I want to see big names, and I hope that we don't see the era of movie stars just completely dying right now.
I mean, the era of the movie star is dead. I feel like there's legit... in my opinion, there's three, arguably four movie stars who they do a movie and people are going to see it for them. There's people who people know, but people aren't going to see it for them. And it's Tom Cruise, Leonardo DiCaprio, Ryan Reynolds, and Scarlett Johansson. Those people have been in bad movies that weren't really based on a known IP that got viewership and made money. Outside of them, like, you have your Chris Hemsworth, Robert Downey Jr.'s, but they go and they try to star in non-IP movies and they just crash and burn.
Yeah, I'm curious what the future looks like, because I'm sad to see this movie go, because I was looking forward to it, you know? I would have definitely been watching this.
Yeah. All right, you ready to talk about some stuff we actually watched on Netflix?
I'm ready. Let's go, Joe.
All right, so one thing I watched on Netflix, you have the documentary MH370, The Plane That Disappeared, and it committed the worst sin I hate in these whole documentary series that Netflix does, which they'll spend like 30 minutes. And if anyone doesn't know, it's the plane that MH370 that it was like 9 years ago was flying, and it just disappeared, and no one really knows what happened. And it's all these Netflix documentary series do it, where they're like, pitch you 40 minutes on a theory, and then at the end they're like, but it couldn't have happened because of X, Y, and Z. And now I'm like, you just wasted my time. Like, if you know it didn't happen when you started recording this part of the documentary and editing this document, why did you put it in here? Like, you could have made a really great hour-long documentary, but instead you made a really mediocre to bad, unrewatchable documentary that's like 3 hours long because you've split it up into 3 one-hour episodes. So if that type of thing doesn't bother you, it isn't kind of interesting. There is a guy you want to punch in the face because his theory that's already been proven incorrect and he still believes is legit, like, tarnishing a guy's reputation. And that's the pilot of the plane where he feels like the guy died by suicide in this, but there's really zero evidence to support that. And his evidence that he has is all just circumstantial and just his explanation for how he thinks it might have happened. And it's already been proven that it wasn't that. No one thinks it was that, but he's still peddling that theory out there. So ultimately, I would say, obviously, it was hyped. It, you know, Netflix has been pushing it. But I would say, unless you're deeply involved in this, you know, story of the plane or that type of thing in documentaries, don't bother you. I could say you could probably just skip this.
Yeah, I like the premise, but these docuseries just seem to be dragging it out for just unreasonably long amounts of time, and that's just what makes me not want to watch them. You know, if it was an actual documentary, an hour and a half, I'd be watching it, but when they give me the multiple parts, and I think, this is not a story that demands this many hours of my time, you know?
Yep. All right, and I know you watched You Season 4 Part 2. What were your thoughts on that? And is it good enough that someone should go back and watch all the other seasons of You?
I think you should go back and watch the other seasons of You. I think it's a really fun show for the first three seasons about a creepy guy who stalks women, and you kind of, your brain starts to want to root for this guy in the worst possible way. You start to question yourself, like, why do I want this guy to get away with this right now? You start to feel a little bit icky, but yeah, you still do want to see him get caught, right? The whole entire time, you're kind of rooting for him to get caught, but in the back of your head, you're thrilled to see him get away with it, right? And that's kind of the premise of the show. Very Dexter-like show, and I unfortunately don't feel the same about season four as a whole. I thought the first half of this season was a great setup. I really liked it. On our review a couple of weeks ago, I talked about how it has this whodunit setup where Joe, who is now kind of the cat of these stories, is now the mouse who's trying to solve this murder mystery, stop his coworkers from being killed off one by one. And then the second half of this pulls a very unsatisfying twist in terms of resolving who the murderer is. I don't necessarily want to spoil it, but I also feel like it was a domino twist that, you know, I almost do want to spoil it, but
spoil it. I'm not going to watch it.
Okay. So if you're going to watch You Season 4 Part 2, you know, skip ahead a couple of seconds, cause I'm going to spoil it's a big reveal. It's the reveal of who the killer is. But the killer that Joe has been hunting the whole entire time is actually Joe. it turns out that he is crazy. He's been imagining a person the whole time. It's a Fight Club kind of ending where the person you've been seeing this whole time as the killer that Joe's been kind of hunting down the whole time, in fact, is an imaginary personality of Joe. He's been doing the killing. He's hunting down himself this whole entire time. And that just feels like a cheap-ass answer to this season's question. And Penn Badgley said he wants Joe to get what's coming to him next season and end this show already, and I kind of agree with him. I feel like the show is thrilling and fun for a while, but when you start pulling out the Fight Club twist, I feel like you've hit like a desperation point. And yeah, give me a fifth season that wraps things up and gives me a satisfying ending, and I'll be happy with that. But as of this season four departure, I thought the setup and the premise were great, but it did not resolve itself in a satisfying way at all to me personally. So I'm hoping that season five is a bit of a step back to form for the show, especially if it's their final season. But season four, okay. The first half is pretty great. I thought a really fun setup for the kind of eat the rich campiness of the season, and then it kind of just fell off on its face. And I was wondering why they did a two-part release, and I feel like they did that because they knew this was not a great resolution and they wanted to have the good part come out so people were talking about it in a good way, and then the second part comes out and it's getting good views. It's still high on, number one on Netflix's TV list, you know, but I felt very dissatisfied by the way it wrapped up.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, so I'm probably not going to check out season four of You. And also, another docuseries I watched the first couple episodes, was In the Name of God, A Holy Betrayal. And it's about this guy who started a church in South Korea in the 70s. And, you know, he was able to predict things, and he convinced a lot of these college students in the 70s in Korea that he is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He used all this math to prove, like, oh, the Bible says Jesus was resurrected in 1945. I was born in 1945. I can predict all these things. I'm the second coming of Jesus Christ. And all these college students, like, started believing him and thought, like, oh, this guy's Jesus. He's the Messiah. And, like, they're interviewing all these people that were, like, when they went to bed at night and prayed, they prayed. They didn't say, like, in the name of Jesus or, like, in Jesus' name I pray. They said, in this guy, who's, I'm not even going to attempt to try to pronounce his name. But I'm pretty sure this was, like, a South Korean documentary that they just dubbed over in English. But they would say, like, in his name, that guy's name, I pray. And then, like any religious cult leader, he uses his power to sexually abuse women. And it was very tough to watch because there was a string of, like, 40 minutes of this where just, like, this woman gives her account of how she was sexually assaulted by him, and then this woman gives her account of how he sexually assaulted her, and this woman, and this woman, and this woman, and this woman, and it's just like a barrage, and you're like, this guy's just the evil scumbag. And I mean, this church is still ongoing. There's still people that support this church and worship this church. There's offsprings of it, and it's just a wild story. This one, I feel like, as far as what I've seen, doesn't drag out because it's more telling a story. It is repetitive, like I said, with the woman telling the story, but I also feel like it's important. But it's not like, oh, what's our theory? How did this happen? Everyone knows how it happened. They're just telling what happened. So that one, if what I said piques your interest, I would check it out. I feel like it can throw people off because they dubbed over it, but you can hear them speaking in Korean, like, very quietly in the background as, like, the English dub is over it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can tell, like, the Korean person has a lot more emotion behind their words than the dubbed person. So that, I feel like, can throw you off.
It sounds like one that I would actually check out, Joe, so I'm definitely glad you put it on the list here. It's one that I might be watching a couple episodes of this week.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, and that is called In the Name of God, A Holy Betrayal. And Tristan, last thing here on Netflix, I know you watch Luther, The Fallen Son. I believe that's a BBC production, kind of movie based on the show. Well, it's like a continuation story, I guess. But Tristan, have you watched Luther, the show, and is that worth checking out? And then also, is this movie a good follow-up to the show?
I love Luther, the show. I think it's a great BBC production. If you don't know Luther, it follows the detective John Luther, played by Idris Elba, and to me this is like the definitive Idris Elba character. Like, anytime I see Idris Elba in anything, I think about Luther, you know. And the show started off as a pretty straightforward, like, procedural in a way, where he's solving, you know, a crime, a murder or something like that. And this movie, you know, is a bit of a tonal shift. It's more kind of on the noir kind of thrill side of it. I think it's a more action oriented, a bit more kind of maximal than the show is, but I liked it a lot. And you have a really strong cast here, of course. Idris Elba is back in the lead here, but you also have Cynthia Erivo, who you may know from, oh, what did I see her in? She was in a show on HBO Max that I watched. She was also on Widows. She was in Bad Times at El Royale. So she has a couple of good shows.
She's in Harriet, here. Right? Or am I thinking of someone else?
She was in Harriet. That's something that I knew her from. So The Outsider is what I knew her from. She was the main detective on The Outsider, which is a really good HBO show from a couple of years ago. She's in this, and he also got a small role, but Paul McGann, previous Doctor Who, he shows up for a sec, which was nice to see. But yeah, I like this a lot. Luther is a great character, and Idris Elba plays it perfectly. If you want to see Idris Elba as James Bond, this is about as close as you're probably going to get here. This is very much a Bond movie, you know? Whereas Luther was like a detective story, this movie feels like they take that detective and they put him in a Bond kind of story. So I like the action. I think it's a really thrilling movie. And yeah, I'm not sure if this is going to be the last of the Luther world, but I'd be here for more of it because I really like this show. I like this movie a lot. And if you have some interest in seeing, you know, Idris Elba solve some mysteries and get into some action and, you know, show off his James Bond chops, check out Luther, The Fallen Son.
All right. Will do. You ready to move over to Disney Plus?
I'm ready.
All right. We got the first bit of news. We got the American Born Chinese trailer. And they, it's weird because they had the trailer drop the day before the Oscars or the morning of the Oscars. And then, so it has Michelle Yeoh and Kay Huy Quan in the show and like in the trailer because it was after the nominations, but right, like the day of the Oscars or the day before the trailer dropped. And it said like Academy Award nominee Michelle Yeoh, Academy Award nominee Kay Huy Quan. And I thought, and then the trailer aired on ABC after they both won, but during the Oscars. And I'm like, I wonder if they had it set up where if they want to switch out the tags, and they didn't. And I was surprised by that just because it's a Disney Plus show. The Oscars were on ABC. You think that if they were like, hey, we're going to air this commercial during the Oscars, they would have the foresight to be like, if they both win or if any of them win, we're going to switch out the cards that say nominee for winner. But that's neither here nor there. It's just a quick 30-second teaser. Looks fun. Looks very, like, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon inspired. It basically looks like a little kid finds out, or not a little kid, but like a middle school kid in America finds out he's basically lives in the essentially a world very much like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where you can do all of these high-flying, crazy martial arts. It's very, kind of reminds me of, like, Percy Jackson, but instead of like Greek mythology or Roman mythology or whatever that is, it's like Chinese mythology. For a Disney Plus show, honestly, production value, I think it looks pretty good. But Tristan, did you watch this trailer? What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. The production value, like you mentioned, seems like a step up. And I feel like the Everything Everywhere All at Once connection is more than just the cast. You know, I feel like the visual style is similar to Everything Everywhere with the big kind of maximum visuals and the kind of trippiness of it. I feel like they're going to lean into that for sure. When they have three of the four main casts of Everything Everywhere All at Once back, you know, I think they're going to definitely want to be hyping that up. So, yeah, I read the graphic novel it's based off of, and I really liked it a lot. So I'm looking forward to this show. And as I was curious, you know, how low budget, how kiddie is this going to feel? You know, is this going to feel like something where they release it, it kind of gets some viewers and something, but doesn't really, like, it's not a big, huge, big release. But I feel like this feels like it's going to be a big release, especially the fact that both of them won last weekend, and mm-hmm. Stephanie Hsu didn't win, but I feel like she was nominated, and she was great. And I feel like that Disney would be foolish not to push this very, very hard with mm-hmm. this cast down here. So I'm looking forward to this a lot, and I think the casting shows a lot of confidence in the project, too.
Yeah, I agree. It looks very great. I'm happy for Kay Huy Quan, who was like wasn't sure about returning to acting, and now he's got the Oscar. Hopefully this is a big show for Disney Plus that he's starring in, and he can do even more things moving forward. I'm sure he has a lot of big studios calling his agent right now.
Yeah, I'm glad to see it, because you never know, after somebody wins an Oscar, the career could take off or it could kind of flop, you know. And I'm glad to see both of them getting work right afterwards. So that's pretty awesome. Michelle Yu has been signed up for a bunch of stuff, you know, so she's going to be in Wicked Part 1 in a couple of years. So I feel like she's going to have a nice career ahead of her too.
All right. And then we also have Michael Cuesta, who is the director of the Dexter and Homeland pilots, is directing the premiere of Daredevil Born Again. So looks like Disney maybe isn't exactly going to kiddify Daredevil as much as we think. I don't think it's going to be on the same level of when it was on Netflix, but I don't think this is exactly going to be happy, smiley times if this is the director you're going out for your premiere.
Yeah, I like the choice. You know, I think the Homeland pilot is awesome. The Dexter pilot is really good. So that's a great choice. And I feel like he's directing the premiere. I wonder if he'll be directing any more episodes or if it's just going to be he's the launch pad and everybody else will pick it up from where he starts. But yeah, it's a good sign for what they're going to be going for. Those are both thrilling pilots. And I feel like if you can bring that level of thrill into this show, it's going to be a great start for this new era of Daredevil.
And then, so we've had some happy news. Time for some sad news. If you're a Willow fan, it looks like Willow was canceled after season one. Honestly, not that big a shock. I watched, like, the first episode and a half, and I never went back to it. But it came out. I never saw a single person talking about it. It felt like when we were talking about it, we were the only ones. I never saw, like, when episodes came out, I didn't see anyone on Twitter or Reddit even mention it. So I'm sure just the ratings weren't there. But I will give kudos to Disney Plus that unlike Netflix and other streaming services, they did. I mean, maybe they canceled it internally months ago, but at least they didn't tell the public, so maybe it would have had time to grow a following. But I feel like after this time, if it wasn't really getting any viewers, that it made sense for them just to not continue with it.
Yeah, I'm sad because I liked the show, but I also felt like I was the only one who did, you know, and no one was talking about it, and a few people that I saw talking about it were saying, yeah, you know, it's okay. You know, and I liked it. I was looking forward to what they would do with season two, especially if they could up the budget and step things up in the action department more. But yeah, I liked the first season. I think it's still worth watching, especially if you have some love for the original Willow and the characters from that. But yeah, it's unfortunate it got canceled, but I do agree with you. I think the fact that it didn't just cancel like a week after the season ended is a good sign. You know, like at least gave it time, because I feel like, sure, if it was internally canceled, it probably was, but if all of a sudden it started taking off and they were like skyrocketing in views, I feel like they would have changed their minds, you know? And I think Netflix misses that opportunity to really give something a chance, you know? And I think Disney is giving stuff a chance. So you've even talked about Dookie Kami Aloha, a show that I never in a million years would have thought we'd get another season. They were like, oh wait, you know what? We got it in the budget. Let's give them another season, you know? And I like that.
Yeah, and they also brought in, I think as of today, Doogie Howser MD is now on Disney Plus. So they even brought back the OG show onto Disney Plus. The only thing is with Doogie Kame Aloha, I believe they're dropping the entire season on Disney Plus, which if you follow Disney Plus is kind of the death nail for a show. It means we made this show and we might as well put it on the streaming service, but don't expect another season of it.
Yeah, I'll take it.
But hey, it's more. And also I noticed, because we, for anyone watches our show, we don't really talk about it, but we have a Google Doc that we just basically refresh every week, and we both kind of add new stories, we both add what we watch. And I noticed Tristan on here posted our The Mando ratings a bad sign. So I wanted to do some digging, and I see like all these articles coming out saying, like, basically saying that the Mandalorian ratings are bad because Mandalorian season 3 premiere had 1.6, some are saying 1.5, some are saying 1.6, but somewhere in there. You also had Book of Boba Fett got 1.9 for its premiere. Obi-Wan got 2.1, I believe, for its premiere. Andor got like half of what Mando got. But it's all just saying like, oh, the Mando ratings are bad. The Mando ratings are bad. No one's talking about the fact that the season 2 premiere of Mandalorian was 1.04. And the Mandalorian season 2 finale was 1.1. So they got 500,000 more viewers in the season 3 premiere than in the season 2 finale. So the viewership is actually increasing quite rapidly. So it's always kind of interesting how they can fudge the numbers. So to kind of tell whatever story they want. So Tristan, I'm going to flip the question back. Is because of these shows, because I think you and I are in agreement that Andor is probably the best quality show, right? But some could say, oh, they prefer Mandalorian the most. Right, like, like Mandalorian is maybe the more enjoyable show, but obviously Andor is the best quality show. However, they are getting trounced in viewerships by lesser quality shows that are starring more bigger name characters. So do you think this will lead Disney to, in the future, not do shows like The Acolyte and maybe do, oh, we're not going to do like spin-off shows that just aren't fully connected. It's going to be a bunch of spin-off shows like, oh, a young Qui-Gon show. Oh, a Lando show. Oh, we aren't doing Solo 2, but we're going to do a Solo show starring Alden Ehrenreich. Like, do you potentially think, based just on viewership, that that's the direction we're going to go? Or do you think Disney's like, you know what? We don't care. We're just here to make, we're going to try to make quality Star Wars content because that's what Bob Iger said we're going to focus on. What do you think the direction of Disney or of the Star Wars shows is going to be?
I think their biggest direction is going to be a similar direction to the Marvel shows, is that they need to slow down a little bit. And I feel like the numbers are good from Mando Season 2 to Mando Season 3, but I feel like if I was Disney, I'd be nervous about the fact that people watched our lesser show and then didn't come back for the main flagship show that we want everyone to come back for, you know. And they, it did help Season 2 to Season 3, it did get a boost, but I feel like these spinoff shows were there because Disney wanted to boost up Mando's numbers in the end, right? Book of Boba Fett was just a prequel to Mando Season 3, you know, and Obi-Wan Kenobi wasn't connected to Mando at all, but they wanted you to really be on Disney Plus thinking about Star Wars and coming back for the next one. And I hope that, especially because the reception of the first episode was not great in terms of like general public, I'm hoping that people are not checking out. It would be very disappointing if the one season I get back into for Mando, people are like, eh, you know, I'm not watching that. And I wouldn't. I hope that Disney doesn't take this as a note saying we got to do spinoffs now. We got to do everything connected to everything. And that's not what I feel like they should learn from this. You know, I feel like they should learn from this. Let's make a good show that people will talk about because it's good, you know. And people talked about Obi-Wan Kenobi. There was flaws in the production value, but I feel like that was a pretty solid show overall. The plot was good. The character arcs are pretty good. Yeah. Performances are pretty good. And I feel like that reflected in the ratings. You know, people came in, tuned in to watch it. And I think what Mando needs to do is capture that zeitgeist. They got to have an episode that's great, that comes along and blows everybody away. You say, you got to watch Mando because this show is so incredibly good, you know. And I feel like the Mando Season 2 finale had that. People watched and said, oh my God, Luke Skywalker's in the show. You got to watch this. And that probably brought in some of the viewership for Season 3. But yeah, I'm curious as the season goes along and we get more viewership from Nielsen, what it looks like as the season comes along. Because the premiere usually is a kind of high point and then they start dropping off a little bit as the season goes along. Yeah. So if this is their high point, I'm curious what their low point is going to look like.
Yeah. Well, they did. I mean, the season one to season, or the season two premiere to season two finale did gain a slight bit of viewership. It went from 1.04 to 1.1, so it gained about 100,000. But I am curious to see how that grows over time. Obviously, I think you and I are both pretty high on Kenobi, but I don't think that's what the general reaction would be. I wonder what the Mando season 3 premiere would be if like Kenobi was incredible. Like, maybe there's someone out there who's just like, oh, the Mandalorian didn't interest me, but I'm a big Kenobi fan. And if maybe they watched Kenobi and they didn't care for it that much, or it didn't really blow them away. But if Obi-Wan Kenobi, that show blew them away, they'd be like, wow, this is amazing. Maybe I should check out these other Star Wars live action shows. Same with Boba Fett. But do you want to just jump in and talk about Mandalorian?
Let's do it, Joe. I want to hear your thoughts because I know you're passionately in love with the show, so I got to hear what you thought of these two episodes.
All right, so we're going full spoiler territory, so if you're not caught up with Mandalorian, maybe skip ahead a little bit. So obviously we talked about season one. We did a whole special episode one. We did a whole special episode. Episode two, I think, and everyone's pretty much in agreement, this was a great episode, one of the better episodes of the show. You know, it was very, very much straightforward episode. Minds of Mandalore proves my theory that we're going to see Grogu grow up during this show. You see Pelimoto talk about like, oh, I think he said my name, and I've watched that clip, and he says something that's pretty much on par with Peli. Like, it sounded like he said Petty, but, and then, you know, even in episode 3 of this season, when everyone says this is the way, he's, you know, babbling along with them. He's not quite saying this is the way, but he's babbling in like cadence with this is the way. And I think without a doubt, I would put everything I have that he says some word, whether it's dad, I think it's either going to be dad, some form of dad, or this is the way by the season finale of the show. I'll bet everything I have that that's the case. But we're seeing Grogu grow up. We're seeing, you know, you talked about earlier, like, you wanted to see a reason, or you wanted to see growth of him while he was with Luke Skywalker, and we saw it in episode 2 of him using the Force. Of he's not just this small little thing that Din has to take care of. He has agency now. You know, I think this show looked good. Like, there was a problem I think you and I talked a little bit about where you could see the volume in some shots. I didn't have that problem at all in season 2. I had a little bit, or not, I keep saying season. I had that problem a little bit in episode 1. There was like one shot. I didn't have that problem at all in episode 2. And then episode 3, I could kind of see it a little bit. There were definitely some flaws there, but nothing crazy. But yeah, moving forward, I definitely think we're seeing the growth of Grogu. You know, the thing I like right now is I really don't know what's going to happen, because there was this formula that kind of followed in season 1 and season 2, and you could kind of predict where things are going to go. I really have no idea what's going to happen the rest of the season. Obviously, episode 3, this whole cutaway with Dr. Pershing, I listened to the Force Center podcast hosted by Joseph Scrimshaw and Ken Knapsack, and they're always, like, very high. They don't like talking negative about Star Wars because they just feel like there's so much toxicity and so much negative talk around Star Wars. And I could tell that they didn't want to outright say it, but I could tell that they just were not fans of this episode. But I really liked it. I think it tied directly into the storylines and the themes of everything going on directly with things around The Mandalorian. The episode was called The Convert, and you could say, you know, Bo-Katan is a convert just as much as Dr. Pershing is this convert going from the Empire to the Republic. Overlying themes, I definitely think, you know, Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni have talked about how, yeah, this show and this whole Mandoverse story is going to lead into the sequels, and we're seeing that directly here with the whole cloning aspects. And my guess is prediction, if I were had to guess what is going to happen the rest of the season, I think at some point Grogu gets kidnapped again, and then realizes he's going to need a lot of help, and he's going to need a lot of support to rescue Grogu. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see this whole big arc of Din, you know, we saw the Mythosaur, Din Djarin riding the Mythosaur, wielding the Darksaber, going to kick the Empire's ass. And we see this whole arc of him becoming the leader, leading all of these Mandalorians, getting all of these Mandalorians to come together. And I think a great moment, a great story, is right as they're about to charge the Empire, you see Grogu coming back on his own, and that he broke himself free. And that's kind of the big finale, is you're kind of, it almost kind of the end of Deadpool 1, where you're prepping for this big fight, and then it just kind of ends, but almost in a cheering moment, where Grogu comes back and you realize, okay, Grogu doesn't need protection anymore. Grogu is his own thing. He's a Force-sensitive, powerful Force-sensitive in the galaxy. But Tristan, I've rambled for a bit. What have been your thoughts on episodes 2 and 3 of season 3 of The Mandalorian?
Yeah, I start with episode 2 and say that I was really, really happy with episode 2. It's one of my favorite episodes of the show. You know, it leading into the horror and the creepiness of, like, the Mines of Mandalore. There was this crazy alien they introduced that was, like, this slug in, like, this big robotic body that was walking around. And I thought it was such a cool addition to Star Wars. I never quite seen anything like that. Like, it has elements of General Grievous and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. very unique for this show especially. And I love the practical effects of it. And, yeah, I also love the fact that I was thinking, oh, is there going to be a whole entire season of building up to him going to Mandalore, and you're finally going to get him in the pool, the pools beneath the mines, you know, in the finale or something like that. And one episode later, here he is doing it all, you know. So it made me very excited for what the rest of the show is going to look like plot-wise, you know, because they got me very quickly to that plot point that I thought they were going to drag out for a really long time, you know. And they did the same thing in episode 3. I thought the cutaway to this kind of other story could have been jarring and could have been off-putting and could have felt like similar to Boba Fett, where you're all of a sudden into the story, then they pull you to some other corner of the universe to do something else. And it didn't feel like that. This still felt like part of the show for sure. It felt like it was furthering the story, the narrative of Grogu and the experimentation and all of that stuff. So yeah, I think that's going to be great stuff to see as the season goes along, because sure, I'm interested in the Mando and the cult and all of that stuff that he's involved with in the rediscovering Mandalore and all that stuff, but I'm very interested in, I watched Star Wars for the Jedi, you know, for the mythological stuff, for the the kind of big stuff. And I think this episode got into that. It really set us up for some of the questions we're going to be asking about Grogu and what his role is in all of this. And I also want to shout out Caddy M. O'Brien, who played the kind of the sidekick of Dr. Pershing here. She's in a couple episodes last season, but she really got to shine a bit more here. And she was also a really, really great supporting character in Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania earlier in the year. So I think she's going to have a kind of break year this year. Between this and Ant-Man, she's been kind of a shining part on these very small roles. So I could see her being someone to keep your eyes on for future casting and future shows. I think she's going to be a great name to follow. So check her out in the show, too. I like her a lot.
All right. So do you think – and so one of the things is there was a show supposed to be Rangers of the New Republic that was supposed to come out, and then it got canceled, and they said we're just going to weave that storyline and what that show is going to be into these other Mandoverse shows. I very much feel like this whole episode was something that was originally meant for Rangers of the New Republic. Just feels very reminiscent of that, of what that could have been. And then also my other thing is, do you think a lot of these things are teases to, especially the stuff on with Bo-Katan and that whole fight and chase scene against the TIE Defenders, or I believe the TIE Interceptor, sorry, is a kind of tease to the Big Daddy, Grand Admiral Thrawn. You know, Bo-Katan throws out a line that was no accident. Seems like a lot of TIE fighters for a warlord, but it may not be too many TIE fighters, too many ships for a Grand Admiral. And then also I saw someone on Reddit point out that same exact tactic of you draw them out with a couple TIE fighters to whisk them away and then bomb the like home base, what they were protecting. And then as they come back, you just meet them with a bunch more TIE fighters. It was the exact same tactic that Thrawn used against the main crew in Rebels in an episode. So do you think there's a chance that this is all leading up, all of this cloning, everything is leading up to Thrawn still working for Palpatine, trying to get something going?
I think that's definitely a possibility. You pointed it out that it's a tactic Thrawn has used before in Star Wars canon, so I think that they're definitely leaning into that. I'm curious how Thrawn will tie into the plot here, because to me, the cloning and the Grogu stuff, the Snoke stuff, it felt like Palpatine's personal plot and not something that he involved a lot of people in, you know? So as his web kind of spreads and we see more and more people involved in this plot, I'm curious how the role is, like how much knowledge they have of what's really going on, because we're building up to something Snoke-wise, right? That feels like what they're trying to build us up to. Between Snoke and between Palpatine being alive in Rise of Skywalker, that feels like the two big questions that Dave Filoni wanted to answer throughout this Mandoverse in the background, you know? And I'm looking forward to it. Once Thrawn does show up, whether this is a tease for him or not, I think it is a tease for him, but I really want to know how much he knows about this cloning process. How involved is he really? Does he have his own ulterior motives, or is he just kind of like working for Palpatine the whole entire time? I really can't wait to see how this Grogu stuff plays out, because I'm liking the Mando stuff, but I'm finding myself more and more fascinated by it. What exactly happened to Grogu? You know, what was his Order 66 experience like? You know, what happened after that? And what is the main goal of this cloning program? Because I have my ideas, but the ideas have not actually been confirmed by the plot of the show yet, you know? So I don't want to make assumptions that it's Snoke or things like that, but it seems like what they're going for me.
Yeah, there's also a chance that it's somewhat unrelated. Like, they almost want us to think, oh, it's related to Palpatine, it's related to Snoke. But what if Thrawn has started his own cloning project because he needs Force, you know, the Jedi are no more, and he needs an army of Force sensitives to fight whatever the Chiss are fighting out in the Outer Rim.
I think that's a good call, too. I think it'd be a nice subversion. You know, we're all expecting it to be Palpatine and to be Snoke, and that could be a fun twist where it's like not what you think it is at all. You know, what if Order 66 scene happens and it's Thrawn saving Grogu, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that could be very interesting. Thrawn realizing he needs Force sensitives, because if you read a lot of the Thrawn books, essentially Thrawn is working for the Empire to essentially somewhat have ability to have an army to defend the Chiss out in the beyond the Outer Rim, out in the unknown regions against a threat. So they kind of stole They kind of used what was Palpatine's reason for creating the Empire in Legends and gave that to Thrawn for why he joined the Empire and why he became part of the Empire. It was for a larger goal.
Interesting.
And I have one final question for you. How do you feel about the canonization of "Come to the Dark Side, we have cookies"?
Look, you know, it's a meme come to life, you know, and I'm happy to see it. I guess it was cheap. I mean, look, Star Wars is getting a little bit meta. That's kind of cool. You know, you acknowledge a fandom, you acknowledge the running jokes, you know, I think that's kind of fun. It's definitely intentional.
And especially like super subtle, like I didn't even think about it at first. I saw someone post that comment on Reddit and I'm like, there's definitely no way that wasn't on purpose as a nod to that.
Once you said it now, I didn't even think of it, but then I had a click in my brain. I was like, that was definitely what they were going for. And it was definitely intentional.
Yeah. Oh, I do have, I said I had one final, but this is my last. Do you think Bo-Katan is very much like, okay, I'm just going to ride with these. Maybe, you know, this guy Din Djarin, he's very much about the way and following the way, and he has the Darksaber. He basically went back to Mandalore and figured out that we can go back to Mandalore. The Mythosaur appeared in front of him. Maybe he's right. Maybe the way is the way. Or do you think she's just like, I'm just here because I have nowhere else to be, and as soon as I can get out of here, I'm going to leave?
I think she's telling herself the second part. You know, she's telling herself, oh, I'm just here because it's what I got to do. You know, it's my way to survive. It's my way to make it work. But I do think in her head, she's starting to drink the Kool-Aid a little bit, you know? Even in episode 2, when she's talking to Grogu, she's like, or talking to Din, she's kind of getting, you know, so what exactly is the way? And I feel like she's starting to see some of the light there. And I think it'll be an interesting subversion if by the end of this season, Din has totally dropped that cult behind and he's realized that they're wrong and they've been lying to him or something like that, and he's found his own way. But meanwhile, Bo-Katan, who has been against that cult, calling herself the traditional Mandalorian the whole time, she's going to end up kind of being drawn in to that lifestyle and becoming a firm believer, you know? So I feel like that could be a fun way to twist it around, where the cult worshiper becomes the traditionalist and the traditionalist becomes the cult worshiper.
Yep. All right. And yeah, something tells me of this whole thing's going to come to a head between Bo-Katan and the armor, where the armor is going to be ordering people around and Bo-Katan's going to be like, wait, if you follow the way in the way of the old style, this guy had a Mythosaur appear in front of him and he wields the Darksaber, so why are you telling him orders? And when the armor realizes she doesn't have the power, I think that's when things are going to go a little crazy, when maybe some people that are in that covert or culvert, whatever it's called, start deciding they would rather listen to Din because, according to the way, he should be in charge and not her. So, curious to see how that goes moving forward. I'm going to hop over to Bad Batch really quick. Last week's episode, I think, was arguably the best of the series. I know Tristan's super far behind. I keep telling him every week, you need to catch up, but he's missing out on the best Star Wars show running right now. Arguably the best Star Wars show since the Clone Wars Season 7. And this last episode wasn't as good, but it was still quality. The highs maybe aren't as high as some of the other Star Wars animated shows, but the lows are nowhere near the lows of some of those droid episodes of the Clone Wars or some of those kind of weird, random, one-off episodes of Rebels. But yeah, I feel like The Bad Batch is definitely, like I said, the best Star Wars show running right now and probably the best since Clone Wars Season 7.
I said every week, Joe, but I gotta catch up. When is the finale of the season? Do we know the date?
I think it's 2 weeks away, 3 weeks away. I will say you watch Miley Cyrus Endless Summer. While you talk about that, I will look up the finale of Bad Batch and let you know.
Yeah, I watched the Miley Cyrus Endless Summer. There's been a couple of live behind-the-scenes album things like this from Disney+. The first one was Taylor Swift's Folklore Sessions, and then a couple of months after that, they had a Billie Eilish live directed by Robert Rodriguez, which was okay, but I thought the Taylor Swift one was really insightful and kind of brought you some knowledge on the music process that she was thinking of and her editing process, her production process, her thought process in the writing and what she was kind of trying to go for and tell in all the songs. And the Billie Eilish one was mostly just a live performance, you know, and if you like the Billie Eilish music, you're going to like the Billie Eilish show, but it's not going to draw anybody new in necessarily. But I thought this was the best of both worlds. If you want to throw back to some Miley Cyrus old school days, I think it had the live performance was really good. Her voice is just great in this. I was really impressed by her vocal performance. And you think of pop artists, you don't necessarily always think of like their vocal talents, you know, and I think this shows off her vocal talents. She does a good job too of covering the most of the new album, but also bringing in a couple of the old hits. You know, she plays The Climb again, and it was very cool to see her perform The Climb this many years later, when I feel like she's in a point in her career where she's hit that height that she's kind of been singing about for a long time. She's really become an independent artist of her own accord, and I think this documentary / live concert shows that. You get a little bit of an insight into her thought process and some of the songs. You just get to know her a little bit more, get to know what she does and who her friends are, that kind of a thing. So yeah, I like this. It made me appreciate some of the songs on the album that faded to my memory, didn't really make an impact, but seeing her perform them and seeing her talk about them a little bit and what she was thinking about behind the songs, it made me appreciate them a lot more. So yeah, I like this one a lot. It's not quite to the level of the Folklore sessions, where I really felt like I was gaining an insight onto not just how Taylor was feeling, but like the whole production process and the whole making of the album process. This didn't really get into that level of detail, but it was still great to get a deep dive into this album and to hear the songs perform live. And yeah, I was really impressed by it. So I think if you're on the fence, you're saying, oh, you know, I kind of like Miley Cyrus, I guess, but I'm not like a fan, check it out. You might become a fan after this. You know, I was a passive listener of Miley Cyrus, and I watched this and I felt like I wanted to go listen to more of her music. You know, I knew her as Hannah Montana, and I knew her as Wrecking Ball. I knew her as a couple of the hits, but this made me want to go kind of look at the stuff I miss, you know, so I definitely recommend it.
All right. Yeah, I'm a big Miley fan. I was going to watch this, but I just ultimately didn't get around to it, but I will probably sometime this week, and I'll let you know my thoughts. And to answer the question before, there's 2 weeks left before the Bad Batch. There's an episode next week, and then the week after they're doing two episodes back to back for the finale. So
I will try my best, Joe. I will try my best to get caught up by that finale.
Hey, I said the same thing to you about The Last of Us, and now you're just using it against me for The Bad Batch. But it's okay, because my show's better. You ready to hop over to Hulu?
What do we got from Hulu, Joe? Give me some goods.
Hulu, Only Murders in the Building Season 3 trailer dropped, teasing Meryl Streep is appearing on the show. I've not watched a single episode of this show. I need to. It looks fun. It looks, you know, kind of like a comedic whodunit. That's about all I know about it. I don't know if you've watched it, if you know anything about it, but Meryl Streep.
I watched the first season, and I loved the first season. I thought it was really funny. Selena Gomez, Martin Short, and Steve Martin, they have great chemistry together. You know, and I think Selena Gomez, when I see her on that cast, you necessarily think she's going to be like the outsider, and you know, she kind of is. She's like the young person who's hanging out with the older people, but I think she proves herself as an actress in the show too. Like, I sometimes think of her as like a celebrity and a singer first, but I think it's important to remember that she got her start as an actress on TV, you know, and I feel like this calls back to her comedic talent, and she's really impressive in the first season, and I'm looking forward to watching the second season and also watching the third once it drops. I know that Paul Rudd is in the third season. He was revealed at the end of season two. He's going to be the murder victim of the third season of Only Murders in the Building. So the second season, spoiler alert, it was not really a spoiler, I guess, but the second season's final scene, I ends with Paul Rudd's character being killed. It kind of sets up that the third season's going to be the solving of Paul Rudd's murder. You know, so it'll be fun to see Paul Rudd in there, and I think he's a great addition to the cast too. I don't want to underplay the Paul Rudd addition, because he's going to be a great comedic talent, and I can't wait to see his. Of course, he's a murder victim, but in this show, that the victim is not necessarily only a body. You know, they're going to be a character present in the narrative. So I think Paul Rudd will be a great addition, really fun, kind of Wet Hot American Summer looking performance from him. So I'm looking forward to seeing this season for sure.
Yeah, Selena Gomez, someone who's been around for a while, I definitely think her strengths as a celebrity or as a known entity are definitely in, I think, television acting. I think, you know, when Only Murders in the Building wraps, I think her next move is just to hop on and lead another TV show. I think that's definitely where her strengths lie. But I got a trivia question for you. Do you know the first show that Selena Gomez ever did?
Do not know. What do you got for me, Joe?
She was a cast member along with Demi Lovato on Barney the Dinosaur.
Wow, that's a good poll there, Joe. I did not know that.
Yeah, that was her first, you know, kind of acting role. Her and Demi auditioned back to back. They met each other in line to audition for Barney.
Oh wow.
Yeah, we also have some other Hulu news. Bob Iger says that Hulu's long-term plan is very tricky if Comcast backs out and wants to sell the rest of their shares to Disney. To me, he says it's very tricky. I don't think it is. I think the clear move is just to transfer, because Hulu doesn't exist outside of the United States. All of the Hulu originals are on Disney Plus outside of the United States and maybe Canada. I think if I'm them, the move I do is I take all of the Hulu originals, remove them off Hulu, put them on Disney Plus in the United States, and sell the name Hulu to the highest bidder.
Yeah, I'm curious. I know Bob Iger, he was not necessarily a fan of expanding Disney Plus's branding to being more than just family oriented. So I think when he says tricky, I wonder if that's what he means. You know, like the branding of Disney Plus, he wanted to be a family friendly platform, and if they got to move the Hulu stuff onto there, is that still going to be the family-friendly platform that he wants it to be, you know? But I do think in the end, any content you can add to your platform is a good thing. And I don't think you just get rid of Hulu necessarily, because there's a lot of – Hulu provides live TV. It provides a lot of stuff that doesn't feel on-brand for Disney+. But I do think it is tricky, especially because the competition – you know, Hulu and Disney+ are competitors, and the fact that they're going to be entirely owned by Disney – both of them, I feel like that does create a bit of a competition that maybe even the government would step in and say, okay, we got to do something about this. You guys got to break up one of these two. And I think Disney wants to get ahead of that. So I do think they're going to do some kind of big move with Hulu. So I'm curious what that looks like, because we have Hulu in our lineup. We don't always talk about Hulu. It's sometimes hard to find what's good on Hulu because it's so much on Hulu. It's not even really easy to figure out what is a Hulu original, what's a TV show that was put on Hulu, what's new. So I hope that they can revive Hulu and make it something that's worth signing up for rather than just get rid of it.
All right, speaking of things on Hulu, you watched The Watcher.
And so I did.
Should I watch The Watcher?
The Watcher, I've seen this. I think I might have covered it on this show before, or at least some version of this show. But The Watcher just came out last year. And it was I'm trying to pull up the director's name, because the director, it was her first feature as a director. So that was what really connected me to this. It was directed by a woman named Chloe Akinua. And it follows a woman who, similar like a Rear Window type of situation. She's living in an apartment and she's kind of watching her neighbors across the street. And she thinks that she's maybe being watched too. She has kind of this watcher in the window who's looking at it. She can't really quite figure out who it is, but she's getting convinced that she's being stalked by this guy. And you're following the woman as she's being kind of gaslit by the people around her, saying, oh, look, you're just paranoid. And there's also the premise that she's moved to a country she doesn't speak the language of because of her husband's job, right? So she's in a situation where she doesn't really know how to communicate to the people around her. The police are there trying to interrogate her, but they don't even really know how to communicate with her, you know? So there's that barrier that I think it makes it really interesting and really scary, where you can relate to this woman who is not just being out of her element as a woman being stalked, but also in a country that doesn't even know how to communicate with her. Someone that she doesn't know how to vent her feelings to anybody else around her because nobody really speaks her language. And I think it's very thrilling, it very dark, and there's some great twists and turns around. So if you want to watch a great thriller with a great lead performance that I think is going to launch this director's career, I think you should definitely check this one out. I highly recommend it. It just got added on to Hulu within the last couple of days. It came out in 2022, and it was one of the better movies of 2022. So I definitely recommend checking it out for some great thrills and some great mystery and, you know, some pretty scary stuff by the end of it.
All right, yeah. Yeah, if that definitely sounds like your type of thing, definitely check it out. I don't have anything left for Hulu if you want to move over to Apple TV really quick to end the show.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, just real quick, I don't believe you or I watched this, but Shrinking, the Jason Segel, Harrison Ford show, has been renewed for season 2. And we also have a 10-episode order for a Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson series where they play fictionalized versions of themselves and where Woody Harrelson's family moves in with Matthew McConaughey's family on Matthew McConaughey's ranch. So they've been working together for a long time, friends for a long time. So I'm curious to see what this show would be. Is it going to be shot like documentary style, but it's going to be like clear and obvious that it's fake? Or what's kind of like, how is this show going to exist, I guess? my big question for it. And then finally, Ted Lasso season 3 is finally here. Ted Lasso, big hit show, especially for Apple TV Plus. Any thoughts on Ted Lasso season 3 coming? Have you watched seasons 1 and 2?
Yeah, I thought seasons 1 and 2 were awesome, you know? Really heartfelt stuff. And Ted Lasso is this guy who just is constantly optimistic. He constantly wants to believe in people and have people believe in themselves. And I feel like it's a show that came out in the perfect time when I felt everyone was kind of having a hard time emotionally at that point, you know? And it was the height of the shutdowns, and people were feeling very lonely and very hopeless about the world. And this show came along to tell us, hey, just believe in yourself. Just believe things are going to work out, and maybe they will, you know? And I'm curious what the show looks like now. You know, we're in a different world. Things are a bit more stable, a bit more put together, and the cast has talked, too, about how this season is the end of the story they want to tell. They haven't called it a final season, but they are saying this is the end of the story they wanted to tell, and I wonder what that means. You know, does this feel like a big wrap-up where maybe we get another season, but it's kind of like a refresh? And this first episode does make me kind of feel like that might be the direction that they are going. It's going to be very internal, I think, about Ted Lasso and about his worldview and challenging him in a way. I'm really curious to how they play out some of these character arcs. Last season, we had the character Nate, who kind of showed the negative results of believing in yourself. But now when you believe in yourself at the cost of others, and you become kind of this bitter, resentful person who wants to be the greatest of all time, but doesn't, in reality, doesn't necessarily have the skills to be that great, you know, and that can be very frustrating for someone. And this last season really wanted you to, really struggled for you to want to root for that character in a way that I thought was very poignant and very powerful for a show that's so optimistic and so positive. Take a character that you kind of liked and push him to a point where you don't even know if you want to root for him anymore. And this season, I think, has him shaking a little bit. So a lot of the characters are kind of, they were at a point in season 2 where they were taking Ted's advice to the max, you know, and now season 3, it feels like they're starting to teeter. They're starting to question, you know. There was a big couple that had a big breakup this episode, and I feel like this show is going to bring them back together, I think. But it also feels like a show that would maybe not bring them back together, and show that maybe you can find happiness outside of that core will-they-won't-they relationship of a show. So I'm looking forward to what this season does. I feel like the tone has shifted a bit between season 2 and season 3. It's a bit more of a serious show than it was before, but I feel like that fits where the characters are at right now, and I can't wait to see how the show goes along. Both of these seasons have started off as kind of light, and then as they get towards the end, you really start to feel like you're seeing something serious and you're very invested in what happens to these characters. So I can't wait to see where it goes for all of these people, you know. And they've done a great job in 2 seasons making me care about not just, you know, the main character Ted Lasso, but really caring about everybody on this team, everybody on the opposing teams, everybody involved in like the management of the teams. So I can't wait to see how they wrap this up. If it's the last story of this series, I think they're going to end it on a great note, because it does feel like one of those shows where how many seasons of this can you do before it just becomes hokey and somewhat annoying, that this character is just constantly optimistic and constantly looking on the bright side of things. And I wonder if this show is going to push him to his limit now. You know, are we going to see where he starts to question his own positivity? So I can't wait. Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to the show. And Joe, I feel like it's a crime against yourself that you haven't watched this. This is a show that I think you'll love. You're going to come on. As soon as you watch this show, Joe, you're going to come on and you're going to tell me, man, why did I wait so long? Because this is a show built for me, you know? And I got to get your thoughts on this. Even before you watch Last of Us, you got to watch this.
All right, yeah, I'm definitely going to work on that. I'm excited to watch it. I mean, I definitely know I'm going to love it. I love the commercials that inspired the show. I believe we only have one thing left, and that is to determine our MVP of the week. And I have my nomination. Do you have a nomination for MVP of the week?
I do have a nomination. Going into the episode, I would have said Pedro Pascal, but we had a very Mando light episode of The Mandalorian. He was not necessarily a focal point of the episode. So I'm going to do a twist on there. I'm not going to vote for Pedro Pascal. I'm going to vote this time for Neil Druckmann. And if you don't know Neil Druckmann, he was the creative mind behind The Last of Us video games. He was the storyteller of both of those games, and he was also the storyteller of The Last of Us TV show. Craig Mazin kind of got the headlines. He was the director, the known TV director who was making the show work, but Neil Druckmann was there the whole entire time. He's producer on the show. He wrote the finale. He directed an episode. He wrote a couple other episodes. So I got to give to Neil Druckmann, because not only did he make this show work, but I feel like he really proved that video games can be adapted well. You know, and he made this his baby, made this his pride, and he really put his hands on this thing. And I feel like that made the show work. You know, if you don't have Neil Druckmann, the mind behind the game, also behind the show, I don't think this show works. And I think we talk about how The Last of Us kind of changes the way you talk about video game adaptations. You know, I feel like that's definitely the case, right? We're not going to talk about video game adaptations in the negative light anymore. It's not going to be all bad all the time. And I feel like for the next 25 years, anytime a video game adaptation is announced, people are going to be like, yeah, but The Last of Us is great, so this could also be great, you know? Even if everything after this sucks, people are going to be like, yeah, but The Last of Us, you know? It could be The Last of Us. And I feel like Neil Druckmann is the reason we talk about not just The Last of Us video game, but The Last of Us show. And without him, this show does not happen. It does not get off the ground. And for that, I'm giving him the win here.
Oh, you're nominating him. You're not giving him.
Look, I'm giving him the win on my ballot, the win, you know? On the Tristan Handy, he's got it.
All right, so my nomination, and the one that I feel like you'll agree to, is because if you want to say MVP of the month or MVP of the last few months, you want to say Neil Druckmann, I'd say, okay, maybe. But if we want to say MVP of the week, someone who I think could potentially launch a show from something nobody watches to a show that could be one of the top watched shows on its platform, my MVP of the week is someone whose name I don't even know. I tried to look it up, but I couldn't find it. And that is the casting director for American Born Chinese. To have this show and to cast this show, and right before it premieres, you have two Oscar winners and an Oscar nominee who were complete. I mean, I wouldn't say unknowns, but they weren't Oscar nominees when the show was cast and when the show was made. And now, right before it comes out, you can say we have two Oscar winners and an Oscar nominee. That's why I think the MVP of the week, looking at the trailer, looking at the Oscars, you got to go the casting director of American Born Chinese.
Look, I understand the argument, but I also feel like we should have given them the award in like February or something when they first announced this cast, you know, because
we didn't know that they were going to win Oscars. That's why they're winning is because now they won Oscars, and now it's like, wow, they did a bang up job. We dropped the trailer. I should make even more hype for this show, the casting director of American Born Chinese.
I see your argument, Joe. I will counter you a little bit by saying I don't want to give them a ton of credit for predicting maybe the most predictable Oscar win in the history of the Oscars with the supporting actor win this year. Ki-Hae Kwan literally won like every single award for the entirety of the year except for the one BAFTA. So I feel like it was a pretty known he was going to win this year.
But was it predictable when they were cast?
That's a good question, but I mean, it depends on when they were cast versus when they were announced. Yeah. You know, they were cast in like February.
Let me look when this show went into production.
Because I'm reading on the Wikipedia casting in February of 2022, it was reported that Michelle Yu, Ben Wong, Yihan Yan, a bunch of people all get added to the cast. So I'm guessing February they announced it probably late last year. They were probably negotiating.
Filming began in Los Angeles in February of 2022. So I think they were probably cast, my guess is, at earliest December of 2021. So,
and for me, by December, I already knew who the supporting actor was going to win, and it was essentially a coin toss on Michelle Yu.
But what did your guy do this week?
This week he wrote, he has a writing and a producer credit on the finale of Last of Us.
All right, and he wrote. You did say he wrote the finale. You know what? I will concede. You've conceded a bunch for me on MVP of the week. So what's his name again?
Neil Druckmann.
Neil Druckmann. And so with that, without further ado, the MVP of the week of March 15th, 2023 is Neil Druckmann, which that sounds like a made up name, but it is what it is. Tristan, any final thoughts before we finish the show? We've ran kind of long. This is definitely our longest episode in a long time.
We definitely ran long. I was not thinking I'd be here this long, you know, but it was a good episode. We had a lot to talk about, and yeah, I'm looking forward to next week. More Mando, more Bad Batch, no more Last of Us. Very sad to see that go away. Mm-hmm. But look, Neil Druckmann, you won the MVP. I feel like that's the most prestigious thing you could have gotten this week, you know? I feel like you're calling your agent right now being like, look, I got the MVP on the Hand Plus, you know, up my paycheck a little bit, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right. So before we end the show, I got one final question. Do we see Din Djarin's face before the penultimate episode of Mandalorian season 3?
I feel we do. I feel like he's going to be stepping away from his cult-like mentality. And part of that is going to be him realizing he doesn't have to have his helmet on all the time. You know, Pedro Pascal, I'm sure, likes the paycheck of voicing in the lines, but I'm sure he wants to be able to show off his face and emote a little bit, you know, and be the star of the show. So I think that's what they're going to go for.
All right, so I'm locking you down. You are saying we're seeing his face before the penultimate episode. And without further ado, that ends our long-ass episode. Goodbye.